Today, time for a new global currency, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 24th of August 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And in this week's digest, we look at the latest in the trade wars, the potential for a new global reserve currency, the ongoing market gyrations, and locally, the latest in the high-rise defects saga plus home price movements. And once again, we're going to start with the international context, as Australia's open and trade-exposed economy is significantly impacted by the global scene. But if you want to jump to the local segment, the code is shown below. And in the comments, I've also added in the times for each of the major segments that we covered today. US President Donald Trump was busy on Twitter on Friday. China had imposed retaliatory tariffs on $75 billion worth of US goods. China's Commerce Minister said that on September the 1st and December the 15th, it will impose additional tariffs of 5% or 10% on a total of 5,078 products originating from the United States, including agricultural products such as soybeans, beef, and pork, as well as small aircraft. Beijing is also reinstituting tariffs on cars and auto parts originating from the United States that it suspended last December as US-China trade talks accelerated. China's decision to implement additional tariffs was forced by the US unilateralism and protectionism, the Commerce Minister said in a statement. We want a deal, but it doesn't mean we want a deal that is not based on mutual respect or good for China's interests. A Chinese diplomatic source said, if the United States levies tariffs, China will have countermeasures. Trump reacted to this new round of Chinese tariffs by heaping an additional 5% duty on some $550 billion worth of targeted Chinese goods. So the tit-for-tat trade war escalated once again. And earlier, Trump had also demanded US companies move their operations out of China. The order also came after Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell told the Jackson Hole Symposium that the Fed stood ready to provide stimulus to the economy if needed. Powell has not explained the policies of the rate-setting committee, who are divided between those who want to cut rates aggressively now and those who want to wait for more evidence of a recession. It was actually more a walkthrough of history. And Trump didn't like the speech because it did not signal an aggressive interest rate cut at the Fed's next meeting, which will be in September. And in a tweet, Trump said, my only question is, who is our biggest enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi? That's the Chinese president. Sadly, past administrations have allowed China to get so far ahead of fair and balanced trade that it's become a great burden on the American taxpayer, Trump said on Twitter. As president, I can no longer allow this to happen. He said that United States will raise its existing tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese imports to 30% from the current 25% beginning October 1st. And at the same time, he announced an increase in planned tariffs on the remaining $300 billion worth of Chinese goods to 15% from 10%. The United States will begin imposing those tariffs on some products starting the 1st of September. But tariffs on about half of those goods have been delayed until December. Trump has accused China of unfair trade practices and push for a deal that would rebalance the relationship in favour of US manufacturers and workers. He said, we don't need China and frankly would be far better off without them. The vast amounts of money made and stolen by China from the United States years after years for decades will and must stop. Our great American companies are hereby ordered to immediately start looking for an alternative to China, including bringing your companies home and making your products in the USA. Now, these events straddled the market close. So while markets fell, there is a risk potentially of more damage next week. The S&P 500 fell 2.59%. The Dow was off nearly 2.37%, and the NASDAQ composite was down 3%. The NASDAQ 100, heavily influenced, of course, by some of the biggest names in technology, dropped the most. And the losses were the third worst points loss for the S&P 500 this year and the fourth worst daily point losses for the Dow and the NASDAQ. The three big S&P 500 losses have all occurred in August. The Dow, meanwhile, had fallen as much as 745 points during the session before last-minute bargain hunting trimmed the day's losses. And the Dow has seen six daily losses of 280 points or more in August alone. Friday's sell-off wiped out weekly gains for much of the US stock market. The S&P was off 1.4%, with the Dow dropping 1% and the NASDAQ 1.8%, with a week to go in August. The S&P 500 is down 4.47%, with the Dow down 4.6% and the NASDAQ off 5.2%. August is likely, therefore, to be the second worst month of the year for the indices. The US Treasury yield also fell as investors sought safe haven assets, with crude oil targeted for the first time by Chinese tariffs. They fell sharply. The 10-year Treasury yield fell 1.52%, down from 1.61% on Thursday, and the spread between the 10-year note and the 2-year Treasury note widened to 0.13 basis points. It's unclear what legal authority Trump would be able to use to compel US companies to close operations in China or stop sourcing products from the country. And businesses in the US were not impressed. It's impossible for businesses to plan for the future in this type of environment. The administration's approach clearly isn't working, and the answer isn't more taxes on American businesses and consumers. Where does this end? Said the National Retail Federation. Apple's, whose growth is tied to growth in its Chinese business, was off more than 4.6%, and most big tech stocks were off by similar amounts. While the major averages are sporting yearly gains of more than 10%, the market continues to be buffeted by volatility in large because of the increased tension relating to the US trade battles and President Trump's angry response. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was up 19.12% to 1987. And gold futures for December delivery was up 1.87% to 1,536. It was gold's largest rally for 3 weeks and the first in a while driven by safe haven buying over China. The precious metal had spent much of the early April to mid-August in range-bound trading as longs in the market sought out signs of Fed rate cuts to add to positions. Gold's rally on Friday saw the futures contract rise by about 1% on the week. It's up 7% so far in August and 20% up for the year. So I read with interest the comments from legal and general investment management who are selling gold. They recognize that the People's Bank of China has relayed on several occasions that it plans to diversify its reserves away from US treasuries into other foreign bonds and into more gold. And if you compare China's gold reserves as a percentage of its total foreign exchange reserves with that of other countries, China is starting from a very low base. It was only in 80th place in 2018, according to the World Gold Council, versus the US in first place. This gives China lots of room to maneuver. Recent developments could admittedly offset this somewhat as China has started to severely restrict gold imports by consumers to help control capital outflows. So against this backdrop, they sold their position in gold. And why? They said, it's not that we think the state of the world will turn for the better soon. We have recently increased our recession probabilities. The reason is instead the price. At these levels, we now think it is a good time to take profits on our tactical gold position. Research suggests that the safe haven characteristics of gold often lead investors to make short-term allocations to the metal. So it makes sense to crystallize profits in tactical portfolios and wait on the sidelines until a potentially more attractive entry point opens up once again. It's never easy saying goodbye to a safe haven asset like gold in times of market stress, but we do think discipline is required to get the best outcomes for our clients. I found that very interesting. Crude oil for delivery in October fell 2.53% to $53.95 a barrel, while the euro-US dollar was up 0.58% to 1.1142, and the US dollar index futures was down 0.52% to 97.55. Mark Carney, Bank of England governor, has given a significant speech at the Jackson Hole Symposium in which he outlines some potential steps to a new global currency. He argues that just as sterling transitioned to the US dollar in the 1930s as, if you like, a backstop, something similar could occur again, but rather than having a battle of competing reserve currencies, perhaps an alternative path is possibly via a synthetic hegemonic currency, SHC. This might be based on a network of central bank digital currencies rather than something like Libra.
Basically, he's trying to find, you know, a new definition of the problem that we have with imbalances in the global economy. And he says that, you know, it's a problem for everybody, as we know, when the dollar moves. And maybe that influence is too big, especially for emerging market currencies. And maybe the solution is to try and take away that dominance by coming up with some sort of multipolar virtual currency that won't be as affected by what happens in the U.S.
And so is Carney sort of going out on a limb by himself, or is his view something that's shared by other folks of his stature?
Well, it's the first time I think any of us have actually heard of an idea like this. So, who knows what people are going to think about it. I'm sure we'll hear more about it. But, yeah, I think it's pretty fresh. It's new.
It's fresh, it's new, it's also hot on the heels of EU announcing that they're going to be investigating into Libra, the cryptocurrency that was announced by Facebook, which is yet to be unveiled, of course, as they want to go through the regulators. And indeed, Mark Carney has said it would need analysing. But how much do you think this is a reaction to private sector, to talks of cryptocurrencies coming to the fore, and central banks wanting to get ahead of that curve and have their own to a certain extent?
Yeah, well, just to be clear, he's not talking about using Libra per se. Mm. It would be a currency that central banks bound together and be something provided by the public sector. What he's saying is, look at the technology that we have. Why not, you know, try and piggyback off of that and come up with something similar that's really useful and could make world trade more stable?
And sort of, did he sort of go into the idea of sort of what the mechanism would be to actually, pull this together? I mean, that would be, it seems like this would be a pretty significant effort to get all of the nations on board for this.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the very first draft of an idea. The way he set it up was to say, look, the dollar is dominant now. The renminbi is getting more dominant, Should we try and use the renminbi more? Well, that could be tricky too, because when you have the competing reserve currencies, there's often turbulence with that. So maybe what we need to do is coordinate, look it together, and try and work out a virtual currency that's based on multiple big currencies, so we don't have quite one dominant where one central bank, in this case the Fed, affects so much of what happens in the world.
He's perhaps already come up with the acronym for it, SHC, Synthetic Hegemonic Currency. Best provided by the public sector through a network of central bank digital currencies. When listening to him, how passionate did it seem? Some of the statements coming from him are quite notable. In the longer term, we need to change the game, he said. When the change comes, it shouldn't be to swap one currency hegemon for another.
Yeah, I mean, it's he's trying to think big thoughts here and put out solutions. I mean, I'm sure everyone saw Larry Summers tweeting yesterday that, you know, we need a radical rethink of stuff. We need new solutions. And this is, you know, this is in a lot of ways redefining the problem that, you know, people haven't talked about the dollar's dominance as being what's really driving imbalances in the world. It's just a side effect of, you know, the way that things work. So he's trying to be radical. I think it's, you know, something that a lot of people are going to consider. It's going to make people think.
Well, this, folks, is a big deal. When aligned with the reduction in cash, the migration to digital currencies and globalization, the potential implications are immense. Who, we ask, is running the show? We're going to revisit this in the longer post later, but the global elites clearly have a plan. To round out the market news, let's look at the outcome of some of the other figures. In the UK, the FTSE fell 0.47% to 7,094. The UK Financials Index was down 0.37% to 707.48. And Royal Bank of Scotland was down 0.3% to 182.95. The pound US dollar rose 0.26% to 1.2282. Deutsche Bank fell 1.56% to 6.36. The US dollar yuan was up 0.19% to 7.0960. The Shanghai Composite Index rose 0.49% to 2,897. Silver was up 2.05% to 1739. Copper futures were down 1.91% to 252. The Bitcoin US dollar was up 2.98% to 10,412. The Stocks 600 index was flat at 371.36. The German 10-year bond was down 0.89% to minus 0.678. And the iShares Russell 2000 index fell 3.06% to 145.43. Hi, it's Liz's interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. Now turning to the Australian scene, we published research to show that the interest-only issue is still bubbling along. Our analysis reveals that in the coming 12 months, around 124,000 interest-only loans will need to be switched to principal and interest loans. This is drawing data from our rolling household surveys. This translates to an estimated value of $47 billion and represents a significant proportion of all interest loans coming up for review. Of these, 97.5% are for investment properties. But many will not be able to refinance elsewhere due to tighter credit rules now in force. And you can watch in detail our show, The Interest Only to Principal and Interest Problem. Auction clearances on a percentage basis remain elevated at 73% across the country, compared with 53.3% a year back. But again, we need to be careful as the volumes are lower, significantly lower than last year. There was 1,684 this year, 1,221, of which 723 were cleared last weekend. Not so flash when you look at it in volume terms. Supply is limited now, as many households are sitting on the sidelines. And if you overlay tighter credit supply, then price movements are likely to be limited. However, the markets are turning in some places, at least according to the CoreLogic Index. But just bear in mind, this index is partly driven by the auction results, which, as highlighted above, are myopic. Anyhow, let's run through the results. The CoreLogic Index, the 22nd of August 2019, shows that in Sydney, prices rose 0.1% in the last week. Over the last month, they've risen 0.89%. Over the quarter, they're up 1.26%. Annually, they're down 7.8%. And from their peak, they're down 13.9%. In Melbourne, they're up 0.24% over the last week, up 0.76% over the last month. Over the last quarter, 1.12%. Annually, they're down 7%. And from their peak, they're down 10.1%. In Brisbane, they fell 0.11% over the last week. They're down 0.05% month to date. Over the quarter, they're down 0.55%. Annually, they're down 2.4%. And from the peak, they're also down 2.4%. In Adelaide, prices rose 0.11% in the last week. They've fallen 0.22% in the month to date. They're down 0.76% over the quarter. They're down 1.1% over the last year and down 1.5% from the last peak. In Perth, they were up 0.03% for the last week, down 0.31% over the last month, down 1.73% over the last quarter, down 8.8% over the last year, and from peak down 20.5%. And the major five-city average was up 0.24% over the last week, up 0.54% month to date, up 0.54% over the quarter, annually down 6.7%, and from the last peak down 10.2%. And as I continue to remind you, these are average figures, and of course individual locations and types of property do vary. And here are a few examples which you might want to take a look at. And we can also look at the annual movements based on the CoreLogic series. Sydney prices have started to track higher recently. Bit of a similar story in Melbourne. Brisbane is not showing the same positive uptick, although there is a slight positive movement, I think, in the last week or two. Not so the case in Adelaide. And Perth is still trending down. But the five cities average index is a little higher. And it's also worth noting that vendor discounting, that is the difference between the asking price and the final agreed sale price, may have stabilised in some places. CoreLogic reported that the median vendor discount nationally was 5.9%. At the same time, a year ago, discounting levels were recorded at 4.9%. And the last time discounts were as large as they currently are was in August 2011. The combined capital cities have recorded a slight reduction in discounting levels over recent months, they said. As at July 2019, vendor discounting was recorded at 6.1%, which is slightly lower than the recent peak of 6.3%. Discounting levels have increased from 5.1% a year ago and haven't reached their recent heights any time in the past 12 years. Across the combined regional markets, discounting has increased from 4.7% a year ago to 5.6% as conditions have deteriorated. Although discounting levels across the regional markets are lower than those in the capital cities, there is absolutely no sign of reduction, and the last time discounting was this high was March 2013. But that said, the ABC reported that there are some signs of life in some of the mining towns in Western Australia's Eastern Pilbara, home to the iron mining towns of Newman and Marble Bar. House prices have risen, wait for it, 30% in a year, and rental yields sit at a healthy 14% on average. It is a similar story on the other side of the country, where house prices in Queensland's Central Highlands region, which encompasses the coal mining towns of the Bowen Basin, have jumped more than 30% in the same period. The price hikes come off a low base, and after years of plummeting prices that followed the end of the mining boom. In July 2012, the median price of houses in Western Australia's East Pilbara was $880,000, but by July this year, that figure plummeted to $170,000. That's a massive 80.5% slump. So let's keep some perspective in terms of movements and volumes. There is no miracle turnaround here, despite what local agents in their objective way might claim. and there are still more clouds gathering over the market. And we continue to hold to a more negative view than many, as we discussed in our monthly live stream last Tuesday. Whilst there is a path to property price rises, it's small and of low probability if you take a 2 to 3 year view from our baseline of July 2018. An international crisis is more likely, and that will drop prices further even if we get a small rebound in some places first. And there is plenty of evidence to support falls ahead. Stockland this week, for example, said that settlement defaults spiked in the year to June 2019 to 7%, and that's the highest rate experienced by Stockland since the global financial crisis. Previously, the rate of defaults was around 3%. And they said the single most important factor affecting the company's residential sales has been the lack of bank credit, which I find very convenient. Just remember the high debt we have in the system, and the risk is more marginal buyers are being sucked in. There is, as we know, a drive to offer extra first-time buyer incentives from 1 January 2019, mirroring the scheme in the UK. So it's worth looking at this report from the Daily Mail there. Thousands of first-time home buyers who bought with a 5% deposit just 2 years ago could be in negative equity. The popularity of low deposit mortgages, which help first-time buyers get onto the property ladder, combined with falling house prices, mean many aren't able to sell or get a new loan. It means homeowners could get stuck on expensive mortgages once their fixed rate deal expires. Almost 1 in 5 mortgages issued in the first 3 months of this year, around 38,000, were with less than a 10% deposit. And many of these buyers have used the government's Help to Buy scheme to get on the property ladder. It allows first-time buyers to borrow 20% of the property price, or 40% in London, interest-free if they have a 5% deposit. The loans must be repaid within 5 years, so homeowners often rely on house prices rising in order to help offset the cost of repaying the cash. But house price growth has slowed, with prices falling in London as well as South East and South West England, according to data from the Office for National Statistics. It can also be used only to buy a new build property, which some experts warn have priced higher than second-hand equivalents. The Four Corners programme last Monday shone some light on the issues around poor quality construction. The co-author of a landmark report on how to fix Australia's building industry has declared that she would not buy a newly built apartment given the scale of the problems. If I was going to invest in an apartment, I'd buy an older one. It's common sense, isn't it? It's just logical. Bronwyn Weir told a Four Corners investigation into Australia's building industry, I wouldn't buy a newly built apartment, no. Probably the prevalence of non-compliance has been particularly bad, I would say, in the last 15 to 20 years. It's gotten worse over that period, and that means there's lots of existing building stock that has defects in it. The new reforms won't improve existing building stock, unfortunately. So there'll be legacy issues for some time, and I suspect there'll be legacy issues that we're not even fully aware of yet. Buying off the plan is a really tricky proposition at the moment. And a recent study of apartment building defects in Australia by Deakin University and Griffith University found, wait for it, 97% of buildings examined in New South Wales had at least one defect in multiple areas. In Victoria, the figure was 74%, and in Queensland, it was 71%. One of the study's authors, Deakin University's Nicole Johnson, told Four Corners that previous calls for reform had gone largely unheeded. People have been jumping up and down about this for years and years and years, Dr. Johnson said. There's been lots of committees formed, there's been lots of task forces, and there's been lots of consideration around these, but really nothing has happened. And we discussed the implications of these issues in our recent post, Building Defects Getting Below the Surface. That's with property insider Edwin Almeida. This is a $1 trillion problem, and it's going to resound and resonate for years. For example, residents in an evacuated Mascot Towers building are unlikely to return home before the end of the year, as investigations into the cause of damage to the unit block centre on nearby construction, according to the Sydney Morning Herald. Owners of apartments in the cracked tower block attended an extraordinary general meeting on Thursday night to vote on whether to take out a $10 million loan to pay for early remediation works. At the meeting, apartment owners passed a motion to pay a $7 million levy plus GST rather than the previously estimated $10 million, which included a 30% contingency fund. The vote, which took place after 11 p.m. on Thursday, was not unanimous. The sum will be raised from Mascot Towers owners and will pay for stages 1 and 3 of the complex remediation work. The total cost is now expected to be more than $10 million, but less than $20 million. Yet the property industry disputes that there is a crisis. The chief executive of the Property Council of Australia, Ken Morrison, told Four Corners, "The overwhelming majority of people in the industry are doing the right thing. And in fact, there's great products right across our cities. I think that statistic on building defects points to the fact that when you're doing something very complicated, like building a high-rise apartment building, there are going to be things that need to get fixed up," he said. Asked if he would buy a new apartment, Mr. Morrison replied, "I would absolutely. I think I would be a discerning buyer looking for quality, but absolutely I would." Now, who do you believe? And to make the point, the AFR reported that residents of a Canberra high-rise apartment building avoided potential tragedy this month when a smouldering cigarette ignited combustible cladding on the wall and balcony of a second-level unit. 5 firefighting vehicles rushed to Glebe Park Apartments on the afternoon of August the 7th after the cigarette butt set fire to a cloth-covered sofa on the apartment balcony, and the fire spread to the 100% polyethylene core panels on the building at 15 Cordon Derrick Street. Or again, residents have been ordered to leave an apartment building in Melbourne's southeast, which is covered in combustible cladding. The Moore Dialogue building was deemed unsafe to occupy after an inspection by the Victorian Building Authority's statewide cladding audit on Thursday. Most of the decade-old complex 17 units were already vacant, with the 4 remaining residents giving 48 hours to move out. The VBA's chief executive officer, Sue Edie, said that the decision was not taken lightly. She said the building had a number of defects, including combustible cladding on the external walls, insufficient essential safety measures, and significant water damage that has led to extensive mould. The building count just keeps on rising. And broader economic indicators continue negative, with the CBA August flash PMITM data signalling the first reduction in output since March, with the decline centred on the service sector. New orders also decreased, but employment returned to growth and business sentiment picked up. Currency weakness led to a faster rise in manufacturing input prices, but services costs increased at a weaker pace, as did output prices across both monitored sectors. August data pointed to a decline in the output in the Australian private sector, the first in 5 months, and only the third since data was first collected in May 2016. And the overall reduction was centred on the service sector, while manufacturing production continued to rise slightly. Services companies indicated that a lack of confidence in the Australian economy, and drought conditions contributed to lower activity. A similar picture was seen with regard to new business, with a decline in services leading to a marginal reduction in composite new orders. Total new orders in the manufacturing sector were helped by a return to growth of exports following 2 months of decline. And talking of indices, the Westpac Melbourne Institute leading indicator was a tad stronger. They say the 6 month annualised growth rate in the Westpac Melbourne Institute leading index, which indicates the likely pace of economic activity relative to trend 3 to 9 months into the future, rose from minus 0.09% in June to plus 0.05% in July. Well, that was a big move, wasn't it? This is the first above trend read since November last year. Further confirmation of this around trend reading would be consistent with the economy growing around trend for the last 3 months or 4 months of 2019 and well into the first half of 2020. Westpac accepts that an improving housing market, tax cuts and lower rates are likely to boost momentum in the second half to around 2.5% annualised, somewhere below trend. And that pace is a little below the current at-trend signal from the leading index. However, developments so far in August around the share market, commodity prices and the inversion of the yield curve point to a likely softer August reading for the index, they said. And talking of commodity prices, the iron ore price continues lower at 92.88 compared with the recent high of 123.19. If that sticks or continues to fall, it will make a significant dent in the GDP ahead. And the ACCC reported the annual average retail petrol price in 2018-19 was the highest in real terms, i.e. adjusting for inflation, in 4 years, according to their latest report on the Australian petroleum market for the June quarter 2019. Their report showed that in the five largest cities, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth, the average annual petrol price in 2018 was 141.2 cents per litre, nearly 7% higher than last year. And in nominal terms, with prices not adjusted for inflation, it was the highest annual average price in 5 years. More pressure across the economy as the Aussie dollar slides, as this, of course, was the main trigger. And so to the markets, which are set to fall on Monday, as all the recent trade war action was after the close on Friday.
The ASX 100 was up 0.38% on Friday to 5,405. The ASX Financials Index was up 0.16% to 6,159. The ASX Volatility Index was down 4.56% to 14.83, but still in an area of relatively high risk. ANZ was up 0.23% to 26.64, and CBA said that it has entered into a further agreement to progress the planned divestment of its Australian life insurance business, CommInsure Life, to AIA Group Limited. The planned divestment has been subject to ongoing regulatory approval processes, which has led to an extended period of uncertainty for CommInsure Life. The revised transaction path comprises a joint cooperation agreement, reinsurance arrangements, partnership milestone payments, and a statutory asset transfer. CBA says the aggregate proceeds from the transaction are expected to be $2.38 billion, a reduction of $150 million from the original sale price, and these arrangements are expected to be implemented in a staged manner throughout financial year 20, with CBA to receive approximately $750 million of proceeds and distributions by the end of the first half of financial year 20, and the remaining $1.625 million by the end of financial year 20. CBA was up 0.39% to 77.40. ASIC has commenced proceedings in the federal court against National Australia Bank, NAB, for breaches of the law arising from failures with its introducer program. ASIC alleges that between the 3rd of September 2013 and the 29th of July 2016, NAB accepted information and documents in support of consumer loan applications from third-party introducers who were not licensed to engage in credit activity. The proceedings relate to the conduct of 16 bankers accepting loan information and documentation from 25 unlicensed introducers in relation to 297 loans. And we expect more actions from ASIC across the industry later. NAB was down 0.18% to 2734. Westpac was up 0.22% to 2781. Amongst the regionals, Bank of Queensland was up 0.77% to 9.11. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank was up 0.74% to 10.96. Suncorp was flat at 13.48. And Macquarie was up 0.22% to 124.79, having recovered from its recent lows. AMP took another dive, down 2.91% to 167, and that's an all-time low once again. So the market is still struggling to work out what AMP is really worth. Lenders mortgage insurer Genworth was up 1.30% to 3.11. McGrath, the real estate agency, was flat at 23.5 cents. Yellow Brick Road was also flat at 7.1 cents. And the Australian financial group AFG announced an annual underlying profit of $28.56 million, up 1.8% for the 12 months to the 30th June 2019. Significantly, for the first time, more than half of AFG's gross margin was generated outside of its mortgage broking aggregation business. The continued growth in these diversified earning streams were despite a softer Australian credit market. Residential settlements were down 11.5%. Their own retail mortgage-backed security program passed the $2 billion under management on the back of growth of 50% over the prior year. AFG, the mortgage aggregator, dropped 0.9% on Friday to 220. A Mortgage Choice released its full year results. The 2019 financial year results recorded a 40% decline in its cash net profit after tax from $23.4 million in financial year 18 to $14 million. The decline was driven by an 18% fall, or $2.1 billion fall, in its home loan settlement volumes, down from $11.5 billion to $9.4 billion. The brokerage's loan book also contracted, slipping by approximately $300 million from $54.6 billion to $54.3 billion. A Mortgage Choice CEO Susan Mitchell attributed the fall in home loan volumes to subdued market activity in response to weaker housing market conditions and increased scrutiny on mortgage applications. Mortgage Choice was down 3.52% to 1.095 as it announced a considerable drop in commissions and more pressure ahead, I think. The Aussie US dollar was down 0.10% to end at 67.49 and continues its slide lower. The Euro Aussie dollar was up 0.72% to 1.65. The Aussie Gold Cross was up 2.2% to 2,262, while the Bitcoin Aussie Cross was up 2.88% to 15,496. And finally, before I go, a quick reminder that it's not too late to apply pressure to our politicians relating to the $10,000 cash ban payment limit, which is proposed by the government. Robbie Barwick from the CEC and I discussed the latest on the cash ban. Quiet Australians are speaking. See, the anti-cash ban wave rises. And we note that some accounting bodies are supporting the ban, as the ABC story from Susan Franks, who argues that a lower limit needs to be implemented around $1,000. Note, she is a senior tax advocate for Chartered Accountants Australia and New Zealand. Other accounting bodies, like the CPA, are against the ban. And remember, the bulk of tax avoidance is facilitated by large accounting firms for large corporates and multinationals. So this is an exercise in misdirection. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.